Hello, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. I hope you enjoy this conversation from our 2020 podcast series.
Hello, my name is Tully Lovey. I'm a Melbourne writer and critic, and I welcome you with great delight to this Sydney Writers Festival podcast conversation with Daniel Mendelsohn. To begin with, I would like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of the land on which these Sydney Writers Festival events ordinarily take place, and pay my respects to the elders past, present, and emerging. As I'm speaking today from Melbourne, I extend this acknowledgement to the Bunwurrung and Wurundjeri of the Kulin Nation and pay my respects to the elders past, present, and emerging. Sovereignty has never been ceded. Daniel Mendelsohn was once described as irresistible by the New York Review of Books, this before he became editor at large there in 2019. The Guardian has identified him as a scrumptious stylist. Trained as a classicist, Daniel is a writer, critic, translator, and professor at Bard College. His explorations of memory, narrative, sexuality, and history, both ancient and recent, might be referred to by the same title as one of his essay collections, How Beautiful It Is and How Easily It Can Be Broken. His award-winning work includes The Lost, A Search for Six of 6 Million, and An Odyssey, A Father, A Son and An Epic, along with the soon-to-be-released in Australia, Three Rings, A Tale of Exile, Narrative and Fate. These books are, to borrow one of Daniel's expressions, which is in turn borrowed from a much admired teacher of his, scathingly brilliant. But more than this, they are voyages through history and literature, which return to the emotional landscapes of the individual. In 2009, Daniel's translation of C.P. Kavafi's Complete Poems was published. He has three collections of essays to his name, including the most recent, The Bad Boy of Athens, Classics from the Greeks to Game of Thrones. I could go on, but I fear we will run out of time. Daniel joins us from upstate New York. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, Tully. Thanks for such a generous introduction.
Oh, not at all. Now, I'd love it if you could take us back in time, which you're so adept at doing in your work, to Daniel Mendelsohn as a young boy on the cusp of teenagehood, encountering Mary Renault's books for the first time.
Well, it's a very good place to begin because it's a way of delving into, I think, the two things that I do. One is thinking about the ancient Greeks, and the other is thinking about my own life and my family's life and thinking of ways to make it available to readers in an interesting way. So I grew up in the suburbs of New York City in the 1960s and 70s. And at the age of, I don't know, maybe 11 or 12, I discovered the historical fiction of Mary Renault, which was for me a life-changing experience. I had always, let's face it, I'd always been a strange child, interested in unusual things. And I had been obsessed as a much younger child with Egyptology, archaeology. I continue, I think, to be captivated by the idea of hidden treasures waiting to be unearthed. I think that's a good way of describing pretty much everything I'm interested in. My father, my late father, who knew I was very interested in ancient Egypt, gave me one day, I think I was 12, a novel called Fire from Heaven, which was the first novel in a trilogy that Mary Renault wrote about Alexander the Great, her favorite historical character. And that got me completely hooked on the Greeks. And I've basically been hooked ever since, you know. And I think it's interesting, Tully, that I think because my introduction to Greece was fictional, was imaginative, it it gave me the angle on the ancient world that has basically served me ever since, which is not, so to speak, on my knees, genuflecting before the greatness of the great classics, but as a living civilization, as about people and human experience. And I think in many ways, in a lot of the writing I've done, both in these sort of memoirs that I've written and also in my criticism, where I often sort of go back and invoke the classics as a sort of way of seeing the world, you know, that sense that this is still alive rather than dead as dust is something I've always tried to recreate. And I think it really does go back to Mary Renault's books, which, as you know, because you've read that memoir piece that's in my collection, The Bad Boy of Athens, I was so sort of caught up in her writing, and there are a number of these books, that I started corresponding with her from the age of 15 until she died about 10 years later. So that was a very big event for me, both in my intellectual life and in my personal life as well. And I think, you know, to come back to this idea, it's the entwining of the intellectual and the personal, which is one of my greatest aims, I think.
And you do it so well. I think it's also, it seemed to me to be, you write about it as an awakening of several kinds, and you've referred to it also about there being no cultural external correlatives for what I was experiencing before that time. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes. So the other great subject, I guess, of mine, well, not the other, but another great subject of mine is sexuality. I'm gay. I was a gay child in adolescence. Growing up in the 1960s and 70s, when it was, you know, a very different landscape than it is now. A student of mine recently asked if I had been out in high school, and I burst out laughing. I said, I would have been mugged every day if I had been out in high school. It was a much different environment. And so, you know, obviously, as many people know, classical Athens, ancient Greece, was a culture in which male homosexuality was accepted in certain ways, culturally accepted. And so, and Renault, who was herself a lesbian, I think attached to ancient Greek culture for the same reason, that it allowed one to sort of be open about one's sexuality if you were involved with this civilization. You didn't have to hide it. And so her books, I think for me, you know, the classics are so emotionally fraught and so much more than an intellectual interest, so to speak, because my discovery of Greek civilization, which, as I said, was through Renault's books, was entwined from the very beginning with my exploration of my own sexuality. I mean, it's very hard to now, Tali, it is very hard to recreate what it was like to be a 15-year-old gay kid in 1975. You know, especially now with the internet and you know, there's so much out there. And I'm not saying it's easy for everybody now, not by a long shot, but the resources that are available now. You know, when I was 15, I literally thought I was the only person like this in the whole world. You know, I had no hope of ever meeting anyone. I wouldn't even know how to do that. You know, you felt so isolated, so at sea. And then to discover this culture, which is not only for all other reasons so interesting and beautiful and strange and fascinating, but allowed people like oneself to sort of just be who they were without all this shame and guilt, was a tremendous experience. And so I think that's why, for me, you know, the Greeks, capital T, capital G, is from the very start of my adulthood, really, you know, absolutely infused with so much more than just an intellectual side. It was emotional, it was human, and it was liberating, you know. And I've always tried to, in my own writing about the classics, to convey, you know, some of the excitement and the living quality that this culture has for me. And I think it all goes back to that. I'm very lucky to have discovered her books. And, you know, who knows, if I hadn't, I might be an Egyptologist today. But also to have discovered her. She was incredibly generous to me, this pesky teenager, constantly writing her moony letters, you know, from halfway across the world. She lived in South Africa, you know. And I always wondered what she made of this, you know, because basically she was the first person I came out to, you know, in a letter that I wrote. So all these things were connected in a very powerful way. And that was the beginning.
That was the beginning. And it's almost like you can see the thread from where you take up translating Kavafi's poems. And you've described it being the themes of erotic longing. And I wonder if you might tell us a bit more about Kavafi and your relationship with him.
So I'm a classicist. I went on and I did both undergraduate and graduate degrees in Greek and Latin. But because, as many classics graduate students do, I ended up spending some time in Greece. I ended up learning modern Greek. And I'm so happy to have this conversation with you right now, because I know that Australia has an enormous Greek population, and I'm happy to be talking about this. So I got very caught up in the poetry of Constantine Kavafi, considered to be the greatest poet that modern Greece has thrown off. He actually was part of the Greek diaspora. He was a Greek living in Alexandria in Egypt from 1863 to 1933. Those are his dates. And he, like me, was obsessed with ancient Greek history through all its phases, not just Athens, but also the later periods, Hellenistic Greece, Roman Greece, Byzantine Greece. And like me, was also gay. And his poems basically fall, you know, like my own writing, you know, into these two categories. And often he combines them in a sort of erotic poem set in ancient Greece. So I got involved in Kavafi and ended up doing a translation of his work. And I guess, you know, it's interesting when you're a writer, not only when you're a writer, when you're a reader, you know, you somehow always find the writers that you need, I think. And, you know, I discovered, seriously started reading Kavafi in my late 20s, early 30s, and I began this translation in my mid-30s, and it took me 12 years to do. But that was a wonderful experience to me, because I felt, you know, a kind of kinship with this poet who, like me, was heavily invested in both Greek history and Greek civilization, you know, both in itself and as a kind of safe harbor in which to situate his writing about same-sex desire. You know, you could write in 1895 in Alexandria in Egypt, you could write a poem about two boys, you know, looking at each other from across a smoky room or whatever, and set it in ancient Greece, and it would be okay. You know, people could read that. And so in a strange sense, I feel like it's a kind of parallel life. I was also lucky because I ended up, you know, doing a lot with modern Greek literature, not just Kavafi. And so I got the benefit of a wonderful extra literature to saturate myself in.
It feels to me like what you refer to a lot in an Odyssey of Homophrosyne. Is that how you pronounce it?
Homophrosyne, yeah, Homophrosyne.
Homophrosyne. See, I need to take one of your classes.
I wish you would. And now we can do it by Zoom.
Yes. Okay, that's a deal. I will hold you to it. You have all these listeners as our witnesses. But that moment of recognition, and it's not only one moment, it's kind of this string of encounters that lead to that feeling.
Yes. So as you mentioned, one of my other books, and maybe more than any of my narrative nonfiction books or whatever you want to call them, memoirs, it seeks to do this thing that I was talking about, which is to entwine a personal story with a very serious literary examination of a work, and that, in that case, the Odyssey of Homer, which is a poem I've been thinking about pretty much my whole life. And so in that book, I describe how my then octogenarian father decided to be a student in my first year seminar on the Odyssey, and that was an experience that made me think about both the Odyssey and my father in interesting new ways. That experience was followed by our taking a cruise together that recreated the voyages of Odysseus, and that was quite amazing, I must say. And then he fell ill and died not long after we got home from the cruise. And so this book is about the final year of my dad's life as seen, so to speak, through this prism, as refracted through the prism of the Odyssey. One of the great themes of the Odyssey, as you just mentioned, is recognition. You know, here is this guy, he goes away for 20 years, he fights in the war for 10 years, it takes him 10 years to get home, and then he gets home, he doesn't even know if his wife is still faithful to him, he doesn't even know his son, whom he left as an infant 20 years before, and he has to make himself known to them, right? 20 years is a long time. People change. He doesn't know if he can trust them. He doesn't know who they have become, just as they don't know who he has become. And so one of the great themes of the Odyssey is recognition. And of course, as people who have read it know, the climax of the whole epic in many ways is this scene in which the husband and wife are finally reunited and sort of trick each other into recognizing each other. And the word that you mentioned before, which is a very famous word if you study classics, is homophrosyne. Homophrosyne means thinking in the same way, having the same kind of mind. Homo, as many people know, means the same, as in, for example, homosexual. And frosune means the way of thinking, your way of thinking. So homo frosune means like-mindedness. And there's a famous scene in the Odyssey in Book 6 where Odysseus, in one of his many adventures, meets up with this charming princess, and he's, as he always does, he's sort of playing up to her and being seductive and charming. And he describes to her what a good marriage is. And he says in this passage, the best thing of all is when a man and a woman share the same kind of mind. And when that happens, they are an invincible couple. You know, nothing can tear them apart. And I kept thinking about homophrosyne in different ways when I had this rather remarkable experience with my father, with whom I was not like-minded. You know, he was a scientist, he was a mathematician, I was a literature artsy kid, and we weren't very close for a long time. And so I started using, you know, that's a very good example, Tali, of what I'm trying to do in the book, which I go from the text to real life. And so I analyze this passage about homophrosyne, which I just described to you. And then I sort of tried to take the lessons of that to think about my relationship with my dad. You know, what does it mean to try to be like-minded with someone? What are the benefits of seeing things in the same way? But by the same token, as I certainly learned when I had him as a student, there are benefits to having different kinds of mind from somebody. You know, my father, well, the sort of the punchline of the whole book is after an entire semester, I couldn't get my father to like the Odyssey. You know, he never really liked it. But his not like, he didn't like Odysseus. He didn't like the hero because, and he's right, he's a liar, he's a conniver, he's a trickster. He cheats on his wife, you know, he's a very problematic character. And it's funny because writers love Odysseus because in a funny way, he's the first great writer character in Western literature, right? He tells stories to get out of tricky situations, right? He invents tall tales to squirm out of tough spots. But for my father, that was a great problem. And I'm saying this because thinking of this idea of one's relationships with people, like-mindedness, different kind of mindedness, my father's inability to view the Odyssey and Odysseus in the way that I did was, it turned out to be very productive for me because it forced me to see the Odyssey in a different way, in a way that someone who is not me can read it. You know, my father was not a literature expert as I am, but he was an intelligent reader, and he had a lot of problems with a poem that I sort of unquestioningly adored my whole life. And sometimes unquestioning adoration is not necessarily useful when you're trying to teach a text to a bunch of 17-year-olds. You know, the danger of teaching works that you really love and that you've taught many times is that you get in a groove. You know, it becomes the same old, you know, all the things you're going to say, all the points you're going to make. And having my dad there with his different mind, not like-minded, but with different-minded, forced me to read the text more deeply, I think. So anyway, that's a kind of a great example of what I'm always trying to do, which is to sort of take things from these works, which are very, very old, let's face it. You know, and as everybody knows, this is not going to be news to you. You know, one of the great complaints about the classics and whenever they try to shut down classics departments in universities, they say, well, you know, it's not practical. Why bother reading these 3,000-year-old texts, blah, blah, blah. But you know, what I'm always trying to show is that they do continue to tell us things about real life. You know, so to take another example from the same book, so I had this rather comical experience in the classroom, you know, trying to maintain control of a classroom with 15, 17, and 8-year-olds and one 82-year-old was no picnic, let me tell you. And then this sort of remarkable experience on the ship and seeing all these places and the Odyssey, blah, blah, blah. And then my father had a terrible, devastating stroke and died a few months later. And I remember in just weeks before he died, and he almost made a comeback. He was a tough old bird, and he really, really struggled to come back and almost did. But there was a terrible episode where it looked very bad and the doctor said we should prepare ourselves. And I went into the hospital room and he was just sort of lying there, totally immobile, unresponsive. And I started thinking about the Odyssey. I thought, you know, what does it mean to recognize someone? Here is this person I've known my whole life and yet who was now totally not the person I'd known my whole life. Silent, unmoving, for all I know, unhearing, unresponsive. So who was this person I was looking at in the intensive care unit? Was it my father still? You know, and like many families, we at a certain point had to face this terrible question of life support and whether to do it or not do it. And it forces you into a terrible intimacy with some very terrible decisions based on whether he was still himself, right? You turn off the life support because you say it's not them anymore. right? That's the reasoning. And so these are Odyssean questions. Who is someone if they don't look like the person you used to know, if they don't sound like the person you used to know, if they don't act like the person you used to know? How can you say it's them? That's the question the Odyssey asks again and again, because, of course, as you know, Odysseus is always in disguise, blah, blah, blah. So here I was in the year 2012, thinking about these very ancient Greek topics in a not at all ancient Greek setting. And I'm always trying to remind people that that's why you read the classics.
Daniel, have you taught the Odyssey course again since your father's death?
Yes, I have. I have.
Well, I find it interesting because you've written so well about the ring cycle composition in narrative and how it's circular. And so I wonder about you being in that classroom again after your father's death, but not just after his death. It's almost like you could insert as a digression the whole book that you have written, and you've had an education as you've been speaking about. And so I wonder what it was like to teach it. Did it feel like you were teaching a very different story? And even the process of teaching, did you feel it to have changed from before?
Mm. Well, it's such a good question. And I'm so happy you brought up ring composition, which is this thing I go on about both in the Odyssey book and in my new book, Three Rings, which is this Homeric way of telling a story, which is non-linear. So let's say I'm telling you a story A, and halfway through story A, I realize, oh, I need to pause for a moment and tell you the backstory of story A. Let's call it story B. But while I'm telling you story B, which is the backstory of story A, I may think, I really need to give you some more information to help illuminate story B. And that becomes story C. And so it's this sort of circling away from the main narrative to loop in additional information, but always you eventually come back to the starting point. That's why it's called ring composition. And the Odyssey is very famous for this. It happens in a number of very important scenes. And so I love the way that you are, and I talk about this a lot, as I said, in the Odyssey book, but also in the new book, which is really only about this. It's just a sort of reflection on why certain kinds of stories work so well. So I love the way that you are using ring composition in our conversation to loop back or loop forward from the experience from my father to subsequent experiences I've had teaching the Odyssey. Yes. So in fact, it's a beautiful way to describe ring composition or its effects, because now when I teach the Odyssey to my first year Odyssey seminar students, I am bringing to it the whole experience that I have had, not only from every other time I've ever taught the Odyssey, but from this one unbelievably memorable experience that I had, you know, teaching my father. And so that has seeped in. You know, what ring composition basically wants to remind people of is that you are always the sum of everything that has happened to you. That no story does not have a backstory, if you see what I mean. And that's why I'm so fascinated by it, because everyone has a history. Every history has a history, potentially infinitely. Now, no one has infinite amounts of time to hear every story ever told, but that's only because we don't have enough time. There is a history of every story that was ever told. And so, yes, I'm deeply aware that my return, to use another Odyssean word, you know, my homecoming to the classroom every time I teach is colored by all these other times, especially the one with my father. And in fact, students show up in my class, you know, Now I have this terrible problem because everyone who takes my classes expects there to be some elderly relative of mine hanging out in the background.
You know? Oh, can I? Okay, so here's the deal. If I take your Zoom class, can your mother be in your class, please?
Yes, my mother. My mother, as you know, because I know you follow me on Twitter and I sometimes tweet the bon mot of my mother, who is almost 90 and very, very funny. She's just the other day, she said, "What?" She said, "Everyone is always talking about daddy, 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 because you wrote that book about him. What do I have to do to get you to write a book about me? Die?" And I said, "No, don't worry, I will."
I feel like she is in all your books, actually.
She is, actually.
I'd like to speak further about the notion of outsiderness, a word you use when referring to Toni Morrison and the 2016 book based on her lectures at Harvard, The Origin of Others. In a LitHub interview, you professed, "Without that slightly skewed perspective, you can't do what you're supposed to, which is get behind the narratives of the author you're viewing, of the publicists, of the marketing people, and figure things out for yourself." Could you expand on this quality and what it might mean for a writer and a critic?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that, as I recall, that LitHub conversation was specifically with respect to criticism, you know, the activity of being a critic, which is another big part of what I do. And it's funny because somebody once asked me, and I had never really thought about it before. They said, "Oh, do you think your being gay has had any effect on your writing, apart from the subject matter, you know, about your style of writing or how you think about things?" And I mean, obviously it must have, but I think specifically with respect to criticism, I feel it is just essential to be slightly outside the circle, if we can use that metaphor again. You know, that what, and some people are just born critics. It's a way of looking at the world, you know, that everyone else is reading the book or seeing the movie or the play or watching the TV series and, you know, saying, "Oh, it's great," or "It's not great," or whatever. But you're standing at a slight angle to things and thinking, what's really going on here? You know, that's always my question when I start looking at something that I might be reviewing. It's funny, and I'm going to circle back and try to loop in Cavafy again, because Cavafy was sort of discovered by E.M. Forster, who was stationed in Alexandria during World War I, working for the Red Cross, and they met. And it was Forster who brought Cavafy to the attention of the English-speaking literary world back in England. And it was Forster who coined this famous description of Cavafy as a Greek gentleman in a straw hat standing at a slight angle to the universe. And I always think of that phrase, "at a slight angle to the universe," as a great way to describe what the critic should be doing. Thinking past what's on the surface and going beneath. Certainly, so to go back to the, you know, your question, Tali, about that interview, I think that growing up gay, having a secret, sensing when other people had secrets or feeling that maybe everyone had secrets and that the story that you were getting was not necessarily the real story. I just think that whole mental frame, so to speak, had so much to do with my eventual interest in criticism, because I think that's what criticism does. You know, the publicist says it's great. The audience polls were wild, but what's really happening here? And not just at that level, which is a fairly basic level. Look, publicists are paid to say nice things about, you know, the movie or the book. I have one, thank God, you know, I mean, that's what they're supposed to do. But the critic is supposed to do something different, which is to try to figure out whether there's something happening in the book or the movie or the TV series that maybe the creator wasn't even aware of. You know, which is to me the most interesting problem of all in criticism. So I do think this sense of being slightly at an angle outside an outsider allows you that perspective that is crucial to the act of criticism, that's just me. I'm not giving anyone an instruction here. I'm just saying for me, and I often feel that, now I'm lucky at this point in my career, I get to write about what I'm interested in. You know, when I started 30 years ago, I would write anything for anybody just because I had to pay my rent, And now, the things that I choose to write about are often things where I feel a little itch, like something's not adding, it's like the princess and the pea, that I just feel something that's not, it's not necessarily bad, but something that's not working, or what the play thinks it's about isn't actually what it really is about, or, something like that, where the novel is good for a reason other than everyone else may think it's good. And I find that the most exciting thing to sort of excavate, if I can go back to that metaphor of archaeology, like what's really under there and how are we going to get at it? That to me, I think, is what's exciting in criticism. But to have that, you have to be looking slightly askance.
I love that. And it makes sense of also so much of your narrative nonfiction, as you spoke about, however you want to term it, in how you're positioned. And I'm thinking of, some illustrations of this might be in an Odyssey, you refer to listening to whispered conversations between your paternal grandmother, your mother and aunts about her husband, your father's father as being shell-shocked. And then you have The Lost, where your garrulous maternal grandfather tells you stories as you sit by his feet. Your very presence as a child sets into motion certain reactions by older relatives. And these stories are all snippets. The Holocaust has fragmented these narratives. And then you have in your most recent book, The Lucent Three Rings, you speak of being a hider. And I wonder if this makes you able to recognize, again, there we go, it's recognition, what is hiding.
It's a wonderful way of connecting the three books. I think, it's interesting, Tali, I never really thought of it in this way until you said what you just said, but the quality of childhood experience that is characterized by eavesdropping, hearing adult conversations that you don't quite understand and that you try to make sense of it, often wrongly, until you're much older, when finally, retrospectively, you realize what they were talking about. That to me is very exciting because I was a listener. I listened in on my parents' conversations. I mean, not, pathologically, but I knew as a child that there was this world of adulthood, which, as for all children, was mysterious. And you would hear words that you didn't know. And that to me was very exciting. And it made me interested in piecing together narratives, which is also what a critic does, right? And also what a writer does. To take these fragments and make them into some kind of pleasing whole. You've mentioned my Holocaust book, which actually was the occasion for my first trip to Australia in 2003 when I was researching that book, The Lost, because there was a community of survivors from my family's town that had ended up in the Sydney area. That book is really about piecing together fragments. I grew up in a household that was haunted by this story of family members who had disappeared. And obviously they didn't just disappear. Things were done to them, specific things at specific times in specific places, but those things we could never know. And really that book is an attempt to restore the specificity and the wholeness of their stories that had been taken away from them. So I think, but I relate that in the book, as I think you're right to point out, to my experience growing up listening to my wonderful grandfather, my mother's father, tell stories. And I began to wonder at a certain impressionable age in childhood, why are there all of these complete stories about some aspects of my family's European prehistory, but this one branch represented by my great uncle and his family who were killed in the war has no stories, or just the most tiny fragments of stories. So I think there's, you know, one could say that in the imagination of a nascent writer, a child who's interested already in stories, that tantalizing absences are what get you going. The opacities, the missing material. Look, that's what every mystery is about, every mystery story, right? You have clues, but not a whole story. And at the end of the movie or the TV show, whatever, you finally have the whole story. So there's something about us that enjoys the challenge of a blank or a missing piece. And if you're a writer, you fill it in with narrative. And that's what, to circle back to the beginning of this question that you posed, that's what Three Rings is trying to puzzle out. You know, what is it that is so satisfying about narrative? You know, why do we almost instinctively try to take the random stuff that happens to us in life and put it into a shape, you know, which is the story that we tell about our lives? And what does that shape look like? And quite often, as this conversation proves, it's circular, right? There's a pleasure when you find yourself almost accidentally repeating or circling back to something that came much earlier. There's a kind of pleasure of recognition in that. And that's fundamental, I think, to some narrative instinct in the human species, maybe.
Yes. And also, I think there's something about the recognition of a person who admires or thinks in that way, because there are others who are drawn to the more linear narrative, even if life doesn't go like that. It's a bit like your father, you know, he wanted there to be straight path and results. And for some of us, that's not where the romance lies, I think.
No, my father was a mathematician. I mean, that was, you know, I think you're right to think of that. You know, there are different kinds of people, not two maybe, but there are a lot of different kinds of people, and there are people who enjoy the roundabout way of getting somewhere, and that could be a novelist or a storyteller of a certain kind. And then there are people like my father who was, that's what he was, that was his profession. He was a mathematician who wanted to see straight lines and efficiency, you know, and paradigms. And that's interesting to me because it was a completely different way of thinking to my own. But the friction between these two ways of seeing the world can be very productive.
I want to briefly talk about the idea of the tears in things, which is one that moves through your work. It's there in the epigraph of The Lost, this book that feels to me the quintessential work of nonfiction that addresses the Holocaust in the wake of survivor testimony, a book that couples intense beauty and horror, that combines history and truth-seeking, and that transcends this all to become a work of art. The Tears in Things is there again in An Odyssey, another book of yours I found myself weeping through. And I'm thinking of the tears in Homer's story, particularly those belonging to Odysseus himself, which are derided by your late father, Jay Mendelsohn. It made me think of constructions of masculinity and protection of self, and that to shed tears is not to puncture not only the skin of the world, but of oneself.
It's a beautiful thought. It's a wonderful way to try to connect some of these dots among my own work in a way that I hadn't really thought about until you just said that. And of course, it all goes back to the classics. There's a very famous phrase in the Aeneid of Virgil, sunt lacrimae rerum, there are tears in things, which just says something about the essential, you know, at once beauty and cruelty of life, which is that if you're mortal, you're going to die. So our very condition is open to tears. And I think about that a lot. And I love the idea of looping it into a consideration of masculinity, which obviously as a gay man, I've had to deal with my whole life, basically, because of, you know, perceptions and misperceptions that are common about who gay men are. And one of the things that strikes you when you read both the Homeric epics is how easily these great, great butch, you know, heroes cry all the time, which I think is so great. As you know from reading An Odyssey, my father, I thought it was very humorous, but one of the things about Odysseus that he finds just insupportable is the fact that he's crying all the time. And my father would say, you know, if he's such a great hero, why is he crying all the time? It's funny, a friend of mine who's also a writer pointed out to me that quite often in my reviews, I have talked about my emotional responses to things, and I'll say I burst into tears. And I can think of a few pieces, actually, in which I've done that, particularly in writing about the theater. And I think, you know, maybe because I'm gay and I wasn't hung up on the tyranny of masculinity that I think a lot of straight men have to deal with, not least my dad, you know, that I wasn't ashamed of being emotional in a certain way. And I tried to sort of signal that in my writing, both by my constant recurrence to scenes of crying and the Lost begins, the first sentence of The Lost is about relatives crying. And, you know, it recurs in An Odyssey, it recurs in my criticism. I think not sentimentally, but to signal that, you know, we're all emotional and that's fine. And that emotions can be twined with very high, serious, deep intellectual considerations. But that when you're overcome with emotions, that's okay. That's part of being human too. I think I've sort of maybe more consciously wielded that in my criticism, because of course so many people think of criticism as hard, you know, and, you know, why are you being so nasty about this movie that everyone loves or whatever? But I think, you know, for that reason, I always try to signal when emotions overwhelm you in the act of criticism, because that's modeling what we are as humans. You know, I'm going to tell you a very quick story, Tali, because it goes exactly to this. When I was on my book tour for The Lost, there was a passage I wanted to read. You know, when you do a book tour and you do a reading for 20 minutes and then you talk to the audience and blah, blah, blah. And so you have to have a few passages that become your staples. And there was a passage I really wanted to read. And I was getting ready for my first big event the day after the book was published. And I should say, because this is also, and it has an Australian angle, some of the survivors from Sydney whom I had interviewed for the book flew to New York to celebrate the publication of the book. And we had parties and here I was getting ready to do my first big reading at the big bookstore on Broadway in New York City. And I knew that my Australian friends had flown to be there. And, you know, it was a big, fraught event. And I was rehearsing this passage at home, which was one of the very difficult passages in the book about how one of my survivors learned that his sisters and parents had been killed. And every time I read it, and this is just at home practicing, I would burst into tears I would get through most of it and then I would lose. So I called an actress friend of mine. And this is the punchline, which I think sums up this whole question of yours and your interest in tears and why I think it's important. And I said, Maria, I'm about to do this huge reading, you know, and they had hundreds of reservations and the Australians were going to be there and the other people. And I said, every time I read this passage, I can't make it through it. I cry. What should I do? Because she's an actress. I feel she figured she had to deal with this all the time. And she looked at me and she said, cry. She said, believe me, no one is going to mind. And so I went to the bookstore. It was very exciting. Did my thing, read the passage, tried to control myself, but I was overwhelmed. And I started weeping. And I was looking down at the book and I looked up and everybody in the audience was crying. So what's so bad about that?
I'm trying not to do it right now. And I'm not going back to my 13-year-old self, which had to do a book report and get up in front of the class. And it was of Miller 18 by Leon Uris, which let's not go into the literary, you know, value of it. But it was about the Holocaust. And I got up and I actually just sobbed and heaved and could not actually get any words out. So that kind of crying does no one any good, except maybe, you know, in a private setting. Let's go to this year, 2020, which... it's a year that will be seared in our consciousness. The United States has been ravaged by the plague of COVID-19. It has experienced social unrest, a swell in Black Lives Matter activism, and political tumult. At the height of the recent American election, you posted on Twitter a Kavafi poem entitled King Demetrius. It was a wishful posting. It felt elegiac in tone. And a day later, Moshe Gessen published a piece in The New Yorker that sought understanding of what America was experiencing through the prism of a poem, Stalin's Epigram by Ossip Mandelstam. In the attempt to encapsulate a truth you both reached for art as a mirror or as a comment on these times, can you talk to us a little bit about art as a source of knowledge or as a mirror or as consolation?
Yes, I look, this is the thing that you are always trying to explain to people if you are yourself, whatever, an artist, a writer, a person involved in the arts, the cultural world, but also if you're a teacher who's teaching these subjects, you know. And I want here in this final moment to circle back to something I said at the beginning about people are always questioning the usefulness, the practicality of the classics of literature. And I always say it depends what you think is classic, what you think is practical, how you define practical. So if you study ancient Greek, no, you're probably not going to get a job as a, you know, someone high up in the world of investment banking and make an eight-figure salary. But what I always like to say is, here's why the classics are practical and why we do turn to them, as I did in my poem and Masha did in her poem and a million other people have been doing. Tens of millions of other people have been doing since this terrible crisis began, already 9 months ago. And suddenly everyone is reading Boccaccio and this, that, and the other. Because, and this is what I always say, Tali, when people question the practicality of studying literature or the usefulness of studying the classics, I said, maybe so. It may not get you a job that's going to make you rich. But when your father has a stroke and lies dying in front of your face, your finance degree is not going to help you. But your classics degree is going to help you. So which is more practical in the grand scheme of life? And that's what I have to say on that subject, you know. And I'm heartened judging, you know, as we do by social media and things people are posting on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, this, that, the other. I'm actually so moved by the extent to which people are going back to poetry. You know, at first it was all about Boccaccio, you know, and the Decameron, because it's about a bunch of people who run away to the countryside to get away from a plague. And who knows, a lot of people discovered actually how great Boccaccio is, aside from the plague stuff. But, you know, people do this. That's what gives you comfort. You know, that's what gives you comfort in the when push comes to shove. That's what we have as humans. That's what we have made. You know, the as my partner likes to say, shrouds have no pockets. Doesn't matter how much money you made at Goldman Sachs. What is the thing that is really going to give you meaning, give meaning to the experience, or help you think through it? That's when the humanities, that's when art and literature and music come in. So I'm very unapologetic and possibly old-fashioned in this way. But what's been happening over the past 9 months throughout the world, not just the U.S., I think is showing us that that's what people turn to. Because without that, you know, what are we? I don't know. I don't want to think about it. I just saw today a friend of mine who's a poet said that somebody's just published a volume of poetry about people dealing with COVID. You know, that's the human response, is to make something. And let's not forget that the word poem in Greek means a making, right? It comes from the word to make. It's we make things that help us to understand our own lives. So that's why it's practical at the end of the day.
On that note, Daniel, it has been a profound pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you. And likewise.
And I hope that you can come soon, next year, the year after, whenever it opens up. You've been listening to Daniel Mendelsohn for the Sydney Writers Festival podcast series. Daniel's books are available from your local independent bookstore, and I do urge you to read them if you have not done so already. And thank you all for tuning in.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe to and rate our channel.